Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Tanya Katsanis, and this week we're turning our focus onto franchising. It seems that the franchise industry has come under the spotlight for all the wrong reasons, including underpaying staff, unpaid, unfair franchise agreements, as well as franchise systems like Aussie Farmers Direct just collapsing. As a result, the franchise industry is now facing a Senate inquiry. I'm joined by a panel of experts this week to expose the good, the bad, and the ugly of franchising. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to On The Money. Australia has the most franchise systems than anywhere else on the planet, with over 1,200 franchise systems creating tens of thousands of jobs. Franchising generates $177 billion in revenue. Many who dream of owning their own small business often think that buying a franchise secures them a safe business that offers support and potentially less risk of failure. After all, it's a proven brand. However, in recent times, when brand heavyweights such as 7-Eleven are accused of underpaying staff and other established brands such as Aussie Farmers Direct go bankrupt, it may not be the safe small business investment. So what's wrong with the industry and how can it be fixed? I'm joined by Dr. Michael Shaper, Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Matthew Wheatley, President of the Franchisee Federation of Australia, and Brad Menachemson, startup investor, board member and ex-franchisor. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, thank you, Tanya. Lovely to be here.
Matthew, I'd like to start with you if I can, because sure. You are the Franchisee Federation president. What's going wrong with the franchise industry in your opinion?
I think there's obviously some issues with the models of these franchises. So they start out with the best intentions and that they're profitable for everyone as the franchises are growing. And at some point, unfortunately, not with all franchisors, but the model or the goalposts change, so to speak. And the model then affects the profitability of the stores on the ground. And on occasion, with some brands, it doesn't necessarily affect the franchisor financially. So then the franchisees do whatever they can to survive, and they're locked into a franchise agreement that may be for a period of 10, 15 years, and they're locked into something that they have no choice but to do whatever they can to survive. And part of those obligations as a franchisee, is to continue to pay the franchise fees to the franchisor. I think there's a major issue in franchising in the country, considering that a lot of franchisees are more fearful of their franchisor than they are the ATO and Fair Work. So that suggests to me that there's major issues in the country.
Now, Dr. Shaper, if I can go to you, what's the most common complaint that the ACCC does receive?
Well, the ACCC is the regulator of the so-called Franchising Code of Conduct, which is a mandatory piece of law that franchise systems have to comply with. And it gives background information about what you have to provide franchisees, startups, before they sign up, dispute resolution during the life of the agreement, and then also the arrangements will apply when the franchise agreement comes to an end. And of course, Tanya, you've got to remember that many franchise contracts last on average for about 5 to 7 years. Now, when there's a dispute with a franchisee and a franchisor, there's a number of avenues. People can come to us. We get about 600 contacts a year. Roughly speaking, about half of them are queries, looking for more information, want to know their rights, and the other half are complaints of one form or another. In addition to that, though, it's also important to bear in mind that franchisees can also go through dispute resolution mechanisms that are meant to exist in each franchise system, and in many states there's also a state-based small business commissioner or the National Small Business Ombudsman to whom they can also refer issues for mediation. So there's a mix of issues. What we do find is that a lot of claims we get or allegations are about issues such as I wasn't fully told about how the franchise system works, I was made false claims about how much I was likely to earn or the amount of effort that I was meant to put in, and of recent times, of course, there's been this issue about termination. Under what grounds and what conditions can a franchisor end my franchise agreement?
Okay, just touching on the disclosure document, in essence, if I can go to you, Brad, because you ran a franchise.
Yes.
You were a franchisor. I would imagine that it would be hard to be able to tell someone how much they're going to be making.
Well, it's aggregated, so it is difficult. But that's one of the biggest issues with the disclosure document the way it is that you can only give a range. It depends on the age of the franchise network as well, though. With us, we were a young network, so we were able to give an ABC range and also determined on the location as well, whether it was going to be a kiosk or a store or a strip store. So that's where the issue comes in, and that's predicated, obviously, on what has happened within the network past, but it's not going to what's going to happen necessarily going forward. So you can only give information in terms of disclosure, and those disclosure documents also don't get updated as properly as regularly as they should. So you're giving information, past information, in terms of result information.
But there is a due diligence that a potential franchisee should undertake, so those questions should be asked.
Well, that's the biggest issue that I see, is that there's two things. One is that the disclosure documents are not the potential franchisee is not spending enough time doing their own due diligence on those disclosure documents. And if they did do that, as well as speak to franchisees existing within the networks and systems, it would give them a much clearer picture in terms of the investment that they're about to make. Those disclosure documents have a lot of information within them. So if you take it to the correct solicitor, which in my opinion has to be a solicitor that can deal with franchising, and you clearly go through those disclosure docs, there are key indicators in there that will tell you about the health of that franchise network to begin with.
Now, Matthew, your experience, because you've also been a franchisee, your due diligence, if we can use that as an example, mm-hmm. did you ask all of those appropriate questions?
Of course I did, but it's like going and signing a home loan where your lawyer's going to sit there and say, look, you either like it or lump it, or you don't sign it. And you're in a situation where you may have stars in your eyes and you're thinking, I'm going to make all this money, and you take note of what's in the disclosure document. But moving back to being able to provide details on the financials and the performance of the business, I mean, as a franchisor, what better way? Who of all people that you would ought to be the ones that would know if it's profitable or not? One of our recommendations with the submission to the PJC was that franchisors should be required to own a minimum of 25% of stores in a particular market or category. That gives them the ability to model and actually provide these financials, and at the same time maybe more consideration in decisions that they make, because it's going to hit their hip pocket as well.
Now, I just want to, in terms of profitability or actually making money, one of the key things that actually has come to light of recent times is underpaying of staff or not paying staff. So when I was reading some of the submissions, before we get onto this next topic, I'm going to quote something from one of the submissions, if that's okay.
Sure.
And it basically says, I went on a series of communication with all levels of Franchisor X management and was told that Franchisor X assumes that all franchisees to work for free. They stated that this is their assumption for their entire network. I have been sent multiple rosters officially where myself and my wife have been rostered to work anywhere between 50 to 83 hours each week with zero pay. If I ever wanted to see a profit, they told me to consider underpaying staff that I can trust. The key message was that as migrants, I must be aware of other migrants or students who would gladly accept underpaying staff that I can trust. So my question is, in order for a franchise to make a profit, is it common knowledge within the industry that people will either not pay themselves as a franchisee or underpay their staff?
I wouldn't say it's common knowledge to underpay their staff, but I say that it's the general consensus of franchisors that if you're a franchisee, you'll do whatever is required. If that means that you've got to do 80-odd hours a week and not get paid, I think the underlying problem around the wages is that there is an underlying issue, and that's predominantly is the model. So and we were speaking earlier before the show, that if you want to start a franchise tomorrow, you can. There's no prerequisites or anything that you need to meet. So I could start one tomorrow, and my model may not be sufficient enough to enable the franchisee to meet their obligations, whether they're as an employer, as running a small business in the country. So that causes massive issues in regards to where the model takes part in this. If a franchisor has a model that is unsuccessful, there's nothing that stops them from selling a franchise tomorrow.
Yeah, and in relation to paying staff, there are only so many controllable expenses within a franchise as a franchisee, and
correct,
that make up. And staff obviously makes up one of, if not the highest component of that. So if you are giving a certain royalty to a franchise, to the franchisor, which is a fixed fee, your rent is a fixed fee, really the only play that you might have, and your supply chain is typically going to be fixed as well, the only play that you've got is wages. And that's why you find these cases where they are underpaying staff simply to stay in business. And the rationale is that if I didn't do that, then all staff would be out, and so would I. So it's better to pay a little bit less. But effectively, obviously, they're breaking the law by doing so. And any network that supports that or advocates for that, well, they should be raked over the coals.
And one of the important things that's probably worthwhile bearing in mind here is a couple of factors. First of all, obviously, we're talking about a small number, but high-profile chains where wages have not been paid. And that, I don't think there's anywhere in the franchising community that would support that. But it is still a relatively small number of different franchise systems out of the 1,200 or so that you quoted at the start. One of the issues that is really important for would-be franchisees, and has been mentioned before by both Matt and Brad, is that issue of carefully examining before you sign up. And a point was made, making sure you're actually talking to someone who's competent in franchising as opposed to just general business issues. Is this model going to work, for example, based on free input of labour? If that's the only way that it works, then really people need to ask the question, should I be signing up for this? Because it's flawed from the outset. One of the great difficulties is that the franchising code already requires people to sign up and take independent advice. But quite a sobering statistic. We, a couple of years ago, had the then Franchising Research Centre at Griffith University in Brisbane go back to a fairly wide sample of new franchise entrants and ask them about their experience. And interestingly enough, the franchise code actually says, I sign a statement saying I've taken independent legal advice, or on the alternative, I sign a statement saying I know I should take it, but I've deliberately chosen not to. So you actually can be very clear, but you have to give the franchisor a statement, one or the other. But you can actually say, I know that I should have, but I've chosen not to take advice. Despite that, a really sobering fact is that half of the people that reported actually signing a statement to the effect that they had got legal, managerial, accounting advice, whatever it might have been, when interviewed by the university researchers, actually came back and said, well, no, I didn't. So we do have a difficulty here in terms of making sure that would-be franchisees are fully aware of all the issues that are involved before they start. And it's a very attractive business model. It works well for the majority of chains, but we do need to make sure that there are reality checks. And that is really hard when people are full of enthusiasm and wanting to start a business.
But there are flaws in terms of franchisors potentially painting a different picture to the reality, because at the end of the day, a franchise is essentially a small business within a larger business. So how do we police, or how do you police the franchisors that essentially paint a prettier picture than what it actually is? And I'll cross over to you if I can, Matthew.
I think that's another issue, that when these these decisions or models or what have you are challenged, with the legal framework that's around now, it's all the subjective tests rather than objective. So assessing a decision that's made, it's okay for a franchisor to say, well, I thought that was the profit it was going to make, or I thought the decision that I made was going to benefit the business as a whole. And they're able to walk away from a decision that potentially decimates these small businesses. But because they subjectively, they thought it was the right thing to do, that's all fine in regards to the legal system. Just to touch on what Michael was saying, I think the education process, and obviously the stories that have been coming out of late, they've educated Australians. I was asked the question that if the franchising model is so broken, why are people signing agreements now? And I would argue that the majority of Australians right now are reluctant to sign franchise agreements, and hence why some franchisors have targeted overseas to sell a dream of coming to Australia, and you can come here and make a lot of money. But there's obviously cultural differences as well. And I think part of the education process needs to be on the people from overseas that are looking to enter in Australia to start a franchise. That's one of the concerns.
Now, Brad, you're shaking, you're nodding in agreement. So do you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to go back, we must understand that when a franchisor is trying to sell to a franchisee, they're trying to sell it. So they're obviously going to put their best foot forward in relation to what they believe their business is going to be able to do. Now, no one's got a crystal ball, and no one can perceive, say, whether their franchisee is going to be able to get the predicated return that that franchisor has said you're going to be able to get. So some owners has to come back onto the franchisee as well to be able to operate within the network and be able to be profitable, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that take the license of the brand and have to run it and make money from it. Where I do agree is that I don't see anyone. I would be very surprised of seeing many people signing franchise agreements at the moment because of the state of the industry, and that's where I'm nodding, and rightfully so. What's really scary was the statistic that was just said, that 50% didn't actually, in terms of taking a look at the disclosure, actually signed off the waiver to say that they didn't get any advice in relation to going into something that's going to cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars and tie themselves up for the next 5 to 10 years. To me, that is just scary.
I think it's a little bit of a cop-out if a franchisor says, well, we don't have the crystal ball and we don't know. If anyone is to know, it would be the person that controls the model, supplies the goods, puts everything in place in regards to that business. They ought to know if that shop can be profitable.
Now, if you've just joined us, you're listening to On The Money's Franchise Edition on 2SER. I'm joined by Dr. Schaefer, Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Matthew Wheatley, President of the Franchise Federation of Australia, and Ben Menachemson, Startup investor, board member, and ex-franchisor. So if we go back to all of that, are some franchisees, do they have unrealistic expectations? Is it they're buying into a business that they think is established, so they're guaranteed a success story?
Yes, absolutely.
Tanya, that's a really interesting one. If you actually look back at the statistics, there's a common belief, and it's almost like one of these urban myths about the success rates of franchise systems over startup independent businesses. Because when you start a business, you've really got three options. You either start it from scratch, you buy an existing business, or you buy into a franchise where effectively you're leveraging someone else's intellectual property, their business model, and so forth. So many people would assume that franchises would have a overall higher survival rate. And interestingly enough, I, a couple of years ago, went back and had a look at some of the research on that very question. And believe you me, there's actually not a great deal of it. But what it does show is that it's actually about the same overall success rate as an independent startup business. So we need to be quite conscious that it is not always a guaranteed rolled gold investment.
In terms of, let's say, franchisee agreement and taking complaints to the ACCC, the process might be a bit lengthy, or taking to litigation becomes expensive. It becomes draining, and this is a family or a franchisee or a business person that's become, I guess, jaded. So moving forward, how do you simplify that process?
Well, we've got an issue here because we have a court-based system, and there are good reasons for having courts, for example, rather than having government agencies that are unilaterally able to, you know, arbitrarily decide who's right, who's wrong, and impose penalties, you know, be judge, jury, and executioner, which is why agencies like the ACCC have to prove their allegations in court so that everyone gets a chance to say that. The drawback, of course, is that it is expensive and it is time-consuming. And on average, the commission can take up to about a year to get the requisite level of proof and another year to get those decisions through the courts. And so we're very mindful of the fact that what often happens is when an individual franchisee or a group of franchisees comes to us seeking a complaint and effectively, in their eyes, looking for justice, that the court system, it's that old one, that old saw about sometimes the courts will deliver the law, but they may not necessarily deliver you justice in terms of it might be 2 years down the track and you're out of business and you're out of
but
money.
But the issue is a lot of these franchisees are already out of pocket. They're pretty much bankrupt. They can't afford to go to litigation. So they're basically defeated before they've even started. So there won't be any justice at all. So how do they get a bit of justice? Will the Senate inquiry deliver any type of solution for them?
Well, it still remains to be seen. I mean, one of the models that Australia has that many other countries doesn't have is the use of small business commissioners in various states and federally. And that is a fairly powerful tool because although each of them have somewhat different powers, many of them can effectively run mediation sessions and with the hope of actually getting both sides in there and getting a livable outcome. It might not necessarily mean that a franchisee's all its complaints are resolve ultimately to all their satisfaction, but it may give them a workable solution. Because we've got two groups of people. We've got those that want to get out of the system at the end, but we've also got franchisees who might be disgruntled, but I'm sure Matt's got members, for example, that, oh, I still want to be in the franchise system, I just want to run differently, better, I need more information, I need more explanation, I need a fairer carve-up of the money than what we've got here. So for them, you don't want to go to court because that's just highly confrontational. What you want is a better way that perhaps preserves the business relationship rather than totally destroys it.
Are we looking at the wrong end then? So rather than solving a problem, should we look at the beginning where a business that wants to become a franchise system has to pass a couple of hurdles to become accredited that they are a sustainable franchise model? Matthew, what do you think? 100%
agree. I don't believe that just simply by starting a franchise tomorrow that you're now, because you've contracted terms in an agreement, that you're above, essentially above the law. The franchise code of conduct, in our opinion, may as well be a piece of paper that's painted in grey paint. There's so many grey areas, and we believe that it makes it and Michael may or may not agree, that it makes it extremely difficult for the ACCC to be able to enforce compliance under the code. You're talking about multinational franchisors that are well-resourced, very creative, and to argue a point over a clause and the determination of the definition or interpretation, of a clause, the franchisor will win that every day of the week. We've experienced that. Our other members have experienced that as well, spent millions of dollars in the court. And again, as I alluded to earlier, because subjectively, if the franchisor believes that that was the right thing to do, there's no recourse for franchisees at all. There's no justice. I was told by multiple people that, unfortunately, the federal court is a court of law, not a court of justice. And when you're in a courtroom and there's 90-odd franchisees waiting for a result, and it goes the other way, when you're told the entire legal fraternity is gobsmacked that it went that way, you start to ask questions and say, okay, well, where is the support for the mother and father or the husband and wife that runs a small family-operated business simply because they've got a large brand name above their door? Doesn't mean that they shouldn't have, and that they have the money to take these guys on in court. So that's. I believe the code lets franchisees down.
Yeah, it's the code as well as the franchise agreement itself. Franchise agreements are drawn up by solicitors that understand the franchise system and law. So they're always going to favour the franchisor, and franchisors pay a lot of money for those agreements to get written up to reflect that. Yeah. So when you go and argue against it, and the franchisee has decided to sign that agreement, when you go and argue against it, you're probably going to lose every case. But there's, on both sides, mediation happens in the first instance regardless, and the point was made before, either party is going to suffer. There's no one's going to come out of it scot-free.
Now, would you have preferred, if you're, again, coming from a franchisor's perspective, gone through a series of tests, let's say, to make sure that your business at the time was viable franchise? Would you have welcomed that?
No, I probably, as a starting off franchisor, wouldn't have welcomed it. But now I think it's absolutely necessary. I think that's half of the problem, is that anyone can become a franchise company if you've got the money to do so. You don't need a model that's necessarily, you can franchise off one store. You don't need multiple stores to franchise, or a successful store as well. It's whether people are prepared to actually pay to buy into your brand that allows you to franchise.
Now, just to bring people up to speed, Brad was the founder of Wow Cow, which is a frozen yogurt franchise. It's no longer around.
Correct.
How many franchisees did you have at the peak?
At the peak, we had 8 operating stores and 12 signed up franchisees, and a master franchise agreement in Indonesia as well.
And obviously it's no longer around.
No.
So exiting that, how was that dealt with your franchisees?
Obviously it was a very difficult exercise to go through. Our industry, unfortunately, collapsed upon itself. It was nothing to do with the strength of our franchise system. It was more so for the fact that frozen yogurt and dairy in Australia became oversaturated almost overnight, and pretty much every frozen yogurt store doesn't exist anymore that existed, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago. I had to go at the time and dissolve these agreements. There was franchisees sitting with stores and leases, as well as new franchisees in the system that had signed up, were waiting to open up stores. So there was a lot of rebranding, remarketing, and redesign. And then we opened up as small businesses. and had to aid them within that. Well, I aided them within that process as well.
Dr. Shaper, what are your thoughts on having a precautionary set of standards in place rather than going to solving sort of broken down relationships between the franchisor and a franchisee?
Well, I mean, the more we can front load people into thinking very carefully about what they're entering into is important, because there's a salutary example not far from home, as it were, Malaysia, which in about the same time as Australia adopted a franchising code, enacted its own franchising law. But the one difference there was that they actually put a rule in place that required a government agency to approve the use of anyone using the term franchise. As to whether or not that has worked, it's still a really open question, because first of all, it's created a bureaucracy of people that go through and a lot of hoops for franchise chains to jump through simply in terms of paperwork. Interestingly enough, of course, there are a lot of franchises that now basically don't call themselves a franchise. They call themselves a licensing arrangement. They call themselves a distribution network. They still have contracts and they are franchises, but not technically under that law. So they've managed to evade it. Arguably the same problems may exist, but they're not under a quote-unquote franchise contract. They're under a different form of contract. So sometimes that may not always be the answer. The quest for making sure that there is enough information uploaded at the front is really important. The issue about the access to justice. And yet we don't also want to destroy the dynamism, I think, tenure of franchise. Different franchise chains all operate in different ways. We don't want to put them all into a cookie cutter that says you can only operate this way. I think, as Matt has made the point, you need to make sure that there is accurate information, the best information that they have there. We do regularly prosecute people for providing information that is demonstrably false, for example. But there is always going to be, unfortunately, I think, an element of buyer beware here as well.
Thank you. Well, that's all we have time for you this week. It's very insightful and it's a conversation that can take hours and hours and hours. So I'm sure we will have to do part two very, very soon. A special thanks to our guest, Dr. Michael Shaper, Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Matthew Wheatley, President of the Franchisee Federation of Australia, and Brad Menachemson, Startup Investor, Board Member and Ex-Franchisor. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks to our Executive Producer, Roderick Chambers, and Technical Producer, Vincent Su. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can also find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. I'm Tanya Katsanis. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside runnings on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Check out the best of contemporary art, design and social inquiry at UTS Art. From May 1 until June 22, check out Baden Palethorpe's Clanger, a fascinating new take on the Aussie AFL tradition. Featuring a new 36-channel video, Clanger uses anonymous AFL player and crowd data to restage a match in its entirety. As players in the crowd fight for their team, get caught up in the emotional, cultural and aesthetic atmosphere of the game. Head to art.uts.edu.au for more info. UTS Art, a space for art and ideas, sponsors 2SER.
Think digital futures.
Stories from the digital age.
Today's technology transforming tomorrow.
Sundays on 2SER 107.3.
Or you can catch the podcast. Subscribe to Think Digital Futures now on your podcast app of choice.
Coming soon, Think Business Futures. Join me, David Brown.
And me, Nicole Sutton.
From the UTS Business School.
Think Business Futures takes research and real-world examples, and we're going to unpack the many sides of business stories by cutting through the buzzwords.
You can subscribe to it on iTunes or wherever it is you get your podcasts.
Think Digital Futures. Want to listen to 2SER wherever you are?
We're now just a touch away.
Download the new improved 2SER app from your favourite app store.
The 2SER app is available for Androids too.
And it's free.
The new improved 2SER app. Stories, ideas, music.
Wherever you are.